Wow, look at this room. This is so exciting. Welcome, everyone. My name is Denise Dane. I'm the Executive Director for Good Beginnings of the Upper Valley. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. I wanted to welcome you to our 8th annual Dorothy Campion Corcoran Lecture. I also would like to point out that there are a couple of family members of Dottie's here. Polly Campion and her daughter, Ashley Lamb, are with us this evening. So that's very exciting. Right in the middle of the room there. So Good Beginnings is entering its 29th year of operation. We've been serving families with new babies throughout the Upper Valley for all those years. In fact, I was looking through some old paperwork. The first year they served 9 families, and last year we served nearly 250 families. So it's really grown quite extensively in that time. I would like to also point out that I'm sure many of you recognize it takes a bit of effort to pull together an evening like tonight. We have many, many volunteers who have made this evening possible, mostly board members and some staff. I'd like to, in particular, recognize our chair of the fall lecture series, Don Dahlstrom. Don, back of the room, thank you so much for all the work you've put into this. I would also like to recognize Wendy Murphy. Wendy, please stand. Wendy was instrumental in securing this wonderful facility for us, and also in organizing a recording of this evening's lecture, remotely, no less. So I can't point to Ray, or is he the red dot on the camera? Okay. Wendy, also, for those of you who receive the fall newsletter in the mail or in your inbox in the email, anybody receive one? Wendy was also largely responsible for pulling that together, so she's been a very busy woman. She has had some help of all our other board members, and I would also like to thank our staff, Denise Garraby, Program Director over here on the right, and Jen Johnson, who I don't think could be here this evening unless she snuck in when I wasn't looking. She's our data and web specialist. So thank you so much. You have a few pieces of paper in front of you. There's a program evaluation and a hot pink mailing list. At the end, if you wouldn't mind putting them in, there's a wire basket with a cloth lining outside these doors. If you wouldn't mind dropping them in there, if you don't have time to do that, feel free to leave them on the desk and we'll collect them. And without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Janine K. Fitzgerald. Thank you.
Hi. How are you? You good? Yeah? How many of you know I'm not from New Hampshire? Did you figure it out yet? What was the giveaway? I'm a Worcester girl. I have a Worcester accent. Yeah, I don't live there anymore, but I spent a lot of time there. So, it's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here. To be asked to come up to New Hampshire to work with you. So how many of you are parents of infants? Any infant parent here? Infants? Almost? I was going to say, like, almost. What does that mean? Like, I'm almost pregnant. Like, what does that mean? Where's the toddler parents? Any toddler parents here? Wow, look at you all. Preschool. Any school-age folks? Any adolescents? Anybody here for spouses or partners? Trying to figure out how to bust and bribe them? Or how not to? So I've been in my profession for 38 years. My area of specialization is children with challenging behavior. And so what we do is we travel around the country. We work with those children that have what's called expanded vocabulary. Any of you know those? Just means they can't say truck, but they're really close. I also work with seen any of those? That one's called duck lips. It goes all the way up to the other type we call duck because that's what you need to do to stay alive. I work with children that have aggressive and violent patterns of behavior. And I also work with the children that don't listen. Any of you know any of those? That's like about the rest of them. And so, I am a parent. My children are grown. I have a 31-year-old daughter. I have a 28-year-old son and a 27-year-old son. And my two boys actually own a business in New Hampshire. They own Northeast Mountaineering, which is in Bartlett, New Hampshire, and they're leaving in 5 days for an expedition for 1 month to Nepal. They're taking a bunch of people through the Himalayas and up Mount Everest to the death zone. Doesn't that sound exciting? You think not sleeping at night is rough. So, children will have developmental behaviors. You know that? Children will have developmental behaviors. So for those of you that are here representing parents, here's what we say to you. Before the age of 12, your children will experience or exhibit at least 6 developmental behaviors. What we don't know is what stage they're going to exhibit those or what the behavior will be. But you will have to deal with at least 6 and sometimes more. So when we talk about developmental behaviors, what we're talking about is any behavior that we expect to see within the developmental stage the child is in, and it actually serves some sort of purpose in the life of the child. It helps them. So an example is a developmental behavior of infancy is called crying. It starts with the child and it ends with us. It's like, I don't know what am I going to do? And the purpose of crying in infancy is communication. You all know that, right? Different cries for different things, and we're supposed to be able to read those, and sometimes it's not as easy as we think it is to read them. And therefore, we're changing their diaper when they really want to be fed. So then eventually pop a binky in their mouth just when they stop crying, because we can't figure it out sometimes. And then you move into the toddler years, and in the toddler years, biting is a developmental behavior. We expect to see biting in a percentage of toddlers between the ages of 13 months and 24 months. And you say, well, what purpose does biting serve? 1 of 5. So there are children that bite just for experimentation. That's like, I just want to see who screams the loudest when I bite them. So if I bite 3 people, I'll figure out. That's a huge experiment. And then there are children that bite because they need sensory input to their mouth. They need more stimulation to their mouth. And so sometimes as they get older, they're not biting any longer, but they still need stimulation to their mouth, and you'll have a preschooler that will come up to you. And every day will start the same way. It'll be, Dad, can I just tell you one thing? I just got to tell you one thing. Can I tell you one thing? One thing. Just one thing. And then they go into what's called slinky thinking. How many of you know what that is? They start one story and it winds like a slinky until it stretches out like, and they've got 5 stories, and if your one thing has turned into like 45 minutes of like, like, what was that about? When did you stop the first story and go into the second one? So I have that child, that's my daughter. So it serves a purpose of sensory input to the mouth. Biting also serves the purpose of the expression of stress and frustration. So toddlers aren't really good at like saying, I feel stressed. I'm feeling a little concerned right now that you're taking my binky away in my crib. So what do? They bite people. That tells you, I'm stressed out. And then the 4th reason that toddlers will bite, they bite for the reason of power. If I want the toy and you have it, and I don't have the words to ask for it, I bite you, you cry, you drop it, I get it, I win. It's mine. And the last purpose for biting is play. You say, what's that about? Well, I don't know. There was a parent that was in North Southampton, Mass. Came up to me and said, my toddler, you know, he bites me all the time, except, you know, it doesn't seem to be for the first four reasons you talked about. He bites me and he's laughing and he runs away from me. What's he doing? I said, he's playing. She said, what does that mean? I said, there's somebody in your child's life that says something to him like, you're so damn cute, I could eat you up. And then they start gnawing on him. And because he's a toddler, he doesn't understand the difference between what that adult is doing and what he's doing to you, which really is taking a bite out of you. He thinks he's playing. She said, so what do I do about that? I said, well, that's pretty easy, get a new husband. Because when I found out that it was the husband, she said, what do I do? I said, get a new one. She said, no, really. I said, talk to your husband. Just tell him it's a very short period of time before that child grows up and will understand the difference. There must be another way that he can play with him. Like, why couldn't he say to the child, you know, you're so damn cute, I could love you up, and then start kissing all over the child, as opposed to eating him. So I don't even know how that turned out. It was just, you know, one night. So then we go into tantrums. That's part of toddlerhood. And it serves the purpose of autonomy, which is, like, I have my own mindset now, and I will prove it to you. So there are some children that literally hold their breath till they pass out thinking they're getting you back. Somebody asked me 2 nights ago, what do you do? Because I have that child. I said, you stand near them, and when they pass out, catch them. She said, really? I said, yes, really. She said, isn't it going to cause brain damage? No. And in fact, as soon as the child passes out, they stop breathing again, and then they wake up and figure out this didn't work. So toddlers are autonomous little exuberant beings of wonder and curiosity and no impulse control. It's a bad combination. And then you go into the preschool years. For those of you that are parents of preschoolers, your preschoolers are doing a thing called posturing. We see it every day. They walk up to other kids and they say, you're not my friend, you'll never be my friend again, and you're not coming to my birthday party. Like the ultimate preschool threat. And then the other kid says, I don't want to come. Because I already did it to 7 other kids and they're not coming either. That means I have no party, so please come. Well, as toddlers, they figure out that they have power and they start to apply it, but they haven't mastered it all by preschool, and so it's during interactions with their peers that they practice this thing called power, and when you have no friends coming to your party, you learn don't use power that way. It's not a good thing. So there's a lot of developmental behaviors like that, and the one we're going to talk about tonight is the one called not listening. Any of you know that behavior? Not in your house. You know. So if you ask questions, you're welcome to ask questions. We just ask, if you ask them in the middle, we have to get a mic to you so it can be recorded. Otherwise, we can ask them at the end. But if you ask questions, it's framed this way. I have a nephew. You know, this summer when I was camping, I saw this kid in the campsite next to us. That's how you ask those questions, okay? Why do you do that? Because this is your community. And you're going grocery shopping, and then there'll be somebody saying, that's the one. That's the one. I heard her. She talked about her kid. So people have said to me over the years, you know, with all those years in the field of behavior, your kids must be perfect. That's what I want you to understand. My children are children. And they went through developmental behaviors. Here's the difference. I knew what to do when they did it. And sometimes we as parents don't know. It sort of puts us in a state of disequilibrium. So there are a lot of kids that don't listen. And some of them are very bold in the expression. Like, we have kids every day that are in preschool that say things like, I don't have to listen to you. You're not my mother. You don't have mothers up here. You have mothers. You're not my mother. I agree with them. I'm not their mother. But then I tell them you don't listen to her either, so leave her out of it. You know him, right? Your nephew? You know him. 4:30
in the afternoon, asks his mom for a snack. She says no.
Gonna be too close to dinner. The child pulls the chair over, climbs up, gets the snack, looking right at their mom. And then goes and sits in front of a television set and eats it. I'm sitting there, because he doesn't listen. Help! I said, is that okay with you? She said, why do you ask? I said, because I thought I heard you say no. She said, I did. I said, but he's eating it. You don't want him eating it. Don't want him eating it. She said, oh. No. I said, why not? She said, you ever seen him tantrum? I looked at her and said, listen, you're going to pay the piper. There'll be a price to be paid. You just need to decide at what age. I'll tell you those tantrums, because you set boundaries on children at 2 years old, they're tough. But they're worse when they're 12 or 18. Okay? So here's how this starts, not listening. Basically, it is what we call the cycle of noncompliance. When you don't listen in the field of behavior, it's called noncompliance. Kind of a crazy word, but that's what it's called. And so where does it start? It starts with us giving directions. How many of you think numerous times a day you give your children directions? All right? And once we give a direction, children can make a decision. And some children will make a decision to initiate in response to your direction. They'll go off to that, you know, right-hand side over there to other interactions, and life for them will be wonderful. But there are children like me in the world that are thinking, nope, not doing that yet. And then when they don't, we go to the left side. How many of you know when your children don't follow your directions, the first time we repeat the directions? That gives them another decision to make. Will I do it this time or won't I? And there are some kids that by the second time they're cooperative, they get up, they get their coat, go brush their teeth, whatever it is you ask them to do. But there's kids like me in the world that are thinking, not yet. This is going to get better. And so according to the research, parents and professionals tend to repeat directions 3 to 7 times, which is what gets you into bossing, begging, and bribing. So by, you know, the first time we say it, it sounds like, you know, it's time to go brush your teeth, please. The second time it sounds similar. Did you hear what I said? It's time to brush your teeth. Yeah. By the third time it doesn't sound like that anymore. By the third time we're starting to beg them. Like, please brush your teeth. You'd be my best helper. I would love it. I've had such a hard day. I'm so tired. Just work with me, okay? Please. Please just brush your teeth. How many of you know you're begging kids this song? The end of the day, you pick them up at a childcare environment. Please get your backpack. We gotta get home so we can get your brother to a soccer game. I need your help, please. They're thinking like, who the hell are you? Can't you see I'm playing? So when they don't respond to our begging, then we start to bribe. Here's what it sounds like. You get your backpack right now. I got a surprise for you. You don't get your backpack, no surprise. Got a surprise for you. There's some people that beg their kids before the day even starts. They're bribing them. Have a good day, okay? When you come home, if you've had a good day and I get a good report, I have a surprise for you. We'll stop at McDonald's. Well, how many of you know somewhere between childhood and
adulthood, your vision of McDonald's changes. I don't exactly know what age it is. I just know that, you know, we didn't eat a lot at McDonald's with my kids. But we were in Maine. I was with my daughter. She was an adult, and we were shopping in Kittery. And so I got hungry, and I said, you know, can't go to the weather vane. Packed. Starving. Can't go to, like, everything was full. I said, we just walked to the next plaza. I think there's a fast food thing. We can just grab something to hold us over. My daughter, in a horrified look, looked at me and said, Mom, do you know what you just said? I said, I think so. Why? She said, do you want to know what I just heard? I said, what did you hear? She said, Erin, would you like to have diarrhea for a week? I don't know when that shift happened. Because up to a certain age, they were dying to go there. How many of you know? It's like you couldn't go by without five. It's not an 18-month-old five. So we bribe them. And then when that doesn't work, usually by the fifth or sixth time that we give the instruction, now we're into bossing. I love to watch bossing, not because I love the result of it, but because I love to see that, see, adults are smart enough to know, don't say what I'm really saying out loud because there's people out there that could be hearing me. So you soften your voice and it looks like this. Back here. Get your food in that cup. You wait till you get home back, but no treat for you. No surprise. No surprise in the back. How many of you ever seen your brother do that? It is so frequent. That pattern is so frequent and so ineffective. Because your kids are going to grow up and they're going to do it to you. Bad girl. So what happens with that? The more times we repeat, 3 to 7 times, the more times we repeat, the greater the likelihood we move to anger. And once we are in that state of anger, there are two possible scenarios. The first is that we will do or say something we wish we hadn't after the fact. So here's an example of that. You better pick up those toys, and if you don't pick them up, I'm throwing them in the trash. You hear me? I'm throwing them in the trash. And then you're thinking, no, I'm not. That's worth a lot of money. I'm not throwing that in the trash. And the second thing that we do is we give in. So there's a lot of adults that give in. The kids just outlast us. They exhaust us. It's like, oh my God, I'm so tired. Just whatever. Don't even put your hand in there. Slip in your clothes. Change it tomorrow. In fact, maybe we won't change it tomorrow. We'll send you to school with those clothes. It'll save time. Parenting is a crazy thing, you know? Like, how many of you ever thought before you had kids what you now know? Why did we do this? So we give in. Now, whether you do or say something, or whether you give in, it doesn't matter. It's the same to the child. We call that kid's lottery. They're playing the odds. Is this the time you might become the screaming Mimi and then not mean it? Or is this the time you're going to give in? And the odds are in their favor. Because the research says that 75% of the time adults give in. 75% of the time. How many of you, if the lottery tonight was 75% in your favor, how many of you are playing? It's a pretty good deal, right? I don't know what it is, $105 million or something? It always amazes me. When the jackpots get really big, people buy tickets.
Honestly, what's the difference? 10 million, 105 million? Like, how many of you think 10 would be all right? How many of you think 1 would be all right? A half of 1 would be all right. So that's called kids' lottery, and they're just playing the odds. And so, you know, being the mother of 3 children, before I had kids, I had a lot of very hard-set formulas. How many of you know the theory of it all? Yeah, that was cool. Didn't work, but it was cool. And then after I had my daughter, I thought, these theories don't work. It must have been written by people that never had kids. So then I had, like, guidelines. Sort of softened them up a little bit. Well, we'll try it, and then we'll adjust it. Listen, after all the years of parenting, here's what I found out. 1, parenting has an awful retirement plan. You never retire. Doesn't matter how old they get. They're always your kids. Second thing I found out is this. There's babies here. That we have to follow through with our kids. There has to be some sort of system of follow through, because otherwise they will just play the game and keep playing the lottery. And we will reinforce their ability not to respond to our directions. So, here's the general rule of thumb. You ready? Write this down. There's a lot of wisdom in it. Say what you mean. Mean what you say, and don't say it mean. And if you will live by that principle, you'll be in pretty good shape. Because the more kids you have, the more they'll play against you. They gang up on you. Then they stop playing the games like, well, Dad said I could. Isn't that right, Brett? Didn't Dad say I could? And then Brett protects, because Brett knows tomorrow he's going to say, well, Mom said I could. And they want the protection. So I don't think it's okay to get to this thing called anger. I now know that I don't even have, you know, guidelines. That I merely now have suggestions. So I'm going to share with you some of those suggestions. Here's why I understand that. Not only because I have 3 children that are very different in temperament, but I also have been in this profession a long time and realized that there is not a strategy on the face of this earth that works with every child. Nor is there a strategy that works with the same child every day. Nor is there a strategy that works with the same child on the same day at different points of the day. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Well, that worked this morning. Not done anymore. And then on top of that, just when you think you got it figured out, they go into a different developmental stage and present a whole new set of developmental things going on. So you're always in this state of disequilibrium, followed by a period of stability, go into the next state of disequilibrium. How many of you recognize that in parenting? And I have said this for years, that as your children go through developmental stages, you too are going through developmental stages with them, the developmental stages of parenting. By the 3rd one, how many of you know you're more relaxed than you were with the first? Like, my 3rd one, I don't even know we have a photograph of him. He asks all the time, where's my photos? Well, you're in that one.
You're in that one.
Yeah, but Erin has 2 baby books. Well, yeah, we didn't have anybody else. Take hundreds of pictures. How many?
Brett came along, you know, a few of him, most of them, him and Erin.
Corey? You're part of the family, Corey. See, we're all here together. Family, family. So here's my suggestions for you.
My first suggestion is this, that if you want your children to increase their ability to respond or their willingness to respond, we say by the age of 3, 97% of children are becoming more cooperative. Okay? We expect the toddlers to sort of be in that stage of resistance and sort of the power struggle. That's how they figure out power. Okay? But by the age of 3, we do expect children to start to transition to become more cooperative on things. But there are children that don't. And sometimes they don't because we don't have a system that encourages them to become more cooperative and more responsive to us. And other times there could be something within the temperament of the child. How many of you know there are some kids that are just strong-willed kids? I'm not doing that. I'm not going to the store. I hate milk. If I don't get up and move, I don't have to get milk. So here's my first suggestion. Use effective commands. An effective command says this. At that top part where it says directions, when it is something that a child has to do, it should be delivered as a have to do. And when there are choices, it should be delivered as a choice. So what I'm suggesting you do is use your language well. So when you know, it's time to, that's a have to. It's time to brush your teeth. It's time to eat dinner. It's time to, or the direction was, or the instruction is, and it's a statement. But if they have a choice, it sounds like this. Well, we have a couple of choices here. We're going to have something to drink for dinner. We have water or juice. Which is your choice? And then the children will learn, that's when my voice can be heard. But don't keep battling when it's a have to, because children need to learn to be under authority. Does that make sense to you? Because if they don't, there are other associated behaviors by the age of 6 years old. Children that do not respond to adult directions at 6 years old are also children that are at risk for the following. Tantrums. When somebody sets a boundary on them, they will tantrum. They'll fall apart, hoping that the tantrum allows them to get out of the have to. And as they get older, that tantrum then incorporates into it aggressive behavior. So I will up the ante. If you try to make me, I'm bigger now and I can hurt you. And listen carefully. I keep track of questions that parents ask me, and I've kept track of the trends. And the trend 3 years ago of parents of toddlers and preschoolers, number one question I was asked for the entire year was, how do I stop my child from hitting me? There are a lot of children out there that are hitting adults. And the adults don't know what to do about it. But it didn't start with just hitting the adult. It started with, I don't have to listen to you because you don't mean what you say, you don't say what you mean, and you say it mean sometimes. And I don't like it. So I don't want that to happen to any of you. I don't want that to be the experience of your children. So I would say, use your language well. The next thing I would say to you is this. When you deliver a statement, like it is time to get your pajamas on, you must deliver that statement from a distance of 3 to 5 feet from the child. Now, if there are any professionals in this room, you listen carefully at this point. Please do not do what the theory tells you, which is to get close to them, get down to their eye level, and make eye contact. Because they'll hurt you. So a child that doesn't listen, he's 4 years old, his name is Aaron. Aaron comes from a family where there's substance abuse. He plays out keg parties all the time in dramatic play. I get the call because Aaron is scratching. So I go. I observe Aaron to find out he only scratches one person. He scratches his teacher. But every time she sets a boundary on him and he doesn't want to listen to her rules, and says, I feel like scratching your eyeballs out. And then she does this. See, you get it. I don't know why she couldn't get it. She said, why is he scratching me? Like, what part of that did you miss? I feel like scratching your eyeballs. Here they are. I looked at him and he said, I know you think you have a child with challenging behavior, but I think we have an adult that can't read social cues. Probably be a lot easier to help the adult with the social cues. 3 to 5 feet. That's this distance, 3 to 5 feet. He said, why 3 to 5 feet? Because some kids will run away from you. If you're too far away, how many of you know we don't go 3 to 5 feet? We could be watching TV and we're yelling up, hey, you kids, get your pajamas on. I'm gonna be up in a few minutes. I'll be checking. No, you're not. No, this is the boys' night and you never get up. Ever. And if you do, it's to go to the bathroom. See, there's no follow through. But if I'm 3 to 5 feet, how many of you know I can follow through? And they know you can follow through too. And it's important that they know you can follow through. So don't crowd them in and put them into a state of like confrontation or threat. But don't be too far away either that what you're saying is ineffective and meaningless. 3 to 5 feet from the child. And if you are going to stay 3 to 5 feet from the child, it would be helpful if your body language is congruent to the message you're delivering. That means if it's a serious direction, you should be serious. Not screaming, yelling, serious. But I'm working with an 8-year-old. Love this little kid. I think he's hilarious. His mother sees no humor in him whatsoever. She is always nagging him. Nag, 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 nag. Everything he does. Nag, 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 nag. I drove up the other day. He comes running out of the house. He goes, Janine! I said, what? He said, can you do me a favor? I said, I don't know. What is it? I'll tell you if I can do it. He said, can you take her batteries out? The problem was she was standing there and saw no humor in that whatsoever. The other problem was that I'm supposed to be helping her, but I'm laughing my head off. Can you take her batteries out? That's a great one. So we worked on when you express anger or an emotion to a child, don't vent it. Because she screams at him constantly. And now she's in the other extreme. Where now she's not even serious. So when I say keep the body language congruent, here's what that means. She now says to him, I'm really mad at you right now. And I thought, I don't think he knows you're mad. She said, but that's what you want me to do, right? You don't want me screaming at him. You want, yeah, I don't want you screaming at him. But I don't want you singing to him either. Because I don't think he knows you're mad. And on top of your singing, I'm really mad at you right now, you put a dance to it. And then you're smiling while you deliver it. That's a mixed message to a child. So I said to him, how do you know when your mom's really mad now? He looked at me and he said, it's the eyes. Watch the eyes. How many of you know your children know your triggers? How many of you know some of them know them better than you know them? Because they're dependent upon you for their survival. So I have to be able to read, and they're studying you, and you don't know they're studying you. And here's an example from a classroom, New Hampshire.
You'll live for your die here.
This little kid always is asked to leave the circle. He's in preschool to go sit in the chair. He likes to sit in the chair because he can't get dirty. If he gets dirty, he gets a whooping. So I said to him, I said, so when you hurt somebody so that you get to go sit in the chair, what does your teacher say to you, Caden? And he went like this, just like the teacher said it. Caden, over there. Oh, God. We got work to do. 3 to 5 feet. Consistent body language. If it's serious, be serious. No smiles. Firm tone of voice. Not yelling. Not screaming. Firm. So that children will discern when it sounds like it is time to, it means it's time to. Okay? Next thing I would say to you is this. Once you give a direction to a child, you must wait 10 seconds before you open your mouth again. Otherwise, it's called nagging. Nagging, by behavioral definition, is repetition of the same information in quick succession. How many of you know, some of us have mastered that. I'll just show you my house. I have a son, Corey. He's my youngest. Corey is the slowest kid on the face of the earth. Any of you know slow kids? It's like the slowest kid on the face of the earth. So the morning routine was always the same. Despite the fact I know the theory, despite the fact I would tell you to do something different, that's my kid and I'm not doing it. So every morning the same. Come on, Corey, hurry up, let's go, Corey. We're going to be late, Corey. Corey, where's your backpack, Corey? Corey, get your backpack. Where's the paper? Come on, Corey, hurry up, let's go. We're going to be late. Corey, did you have breakfast, Corey? Corey, zip your fly, brush your teeth. Come on, Corey. How many of you know that's called nagging? Wait 10 seconds, you kidding? We'll be there forever. And every time you did that to Corey, he would do this. That's his hurry. So annoying. He'd do this. Corey, what? Mom. He talks slow. That's even more annoying. I said to him one day, don't call me that. Takes too long. Call me Ma, it's faster. Go, Corey, say Ma. Go ahead, say Ma, Ma, Ma. See how fast that is, Corey? He will go, but this bow is bigger than that one. Corey, you're lucky you have shoes. Let's go, Corey. And the next thing you saw Corey do is called no bones. The smirk goes on the face and the body goes like. And they lay there waiting for somebody to help them. How many of you know how obliged we are to help? Sounds like,
get up, I'll help you.
I've watched this for years. Toddlers become football. We pick them up, we tuck them under our arm, they're flailing all over the place, we start running for the touchdown. It's like, we're moving, get out of our way! The preschoolers go walking so fast, holding their hands, they're flapping behind us. They're like, let go of me, you're hurting me. No, I'm helping. I don't know. That's Corey. Here's the end of that story. Corey went to kindergarten. teacher. I know a lot of teachers. But I was the PTA president for years and years. I was also the volunteer at the school. I did all kinds of stuff. She called me first week of school. She said, Janine, can you talk to Corey? I said, Geeta, about what? She said, Janine, you know what it's like? First week of school, we're trying to get the children to learn who each other are and things they like to do. So I've been having the kids stand up, introduce themselves to the other kids, and today I asked them to say something that they like to do. And Corey stood up when it was his turn, and he said, my name is, come on, hurry up, let's go. Yeah, 3 days, Judy. Can you talk to him? Corey came home. I said, Corey, Mrs. Haddad called. He said, yeah, Mom. I said, Corey, she wants me to talk to you. Okay, Mom. Corey, she said, you introduced yourself as, come on, hurry up, let's go, Corey. He said, yeah, Mom. Isn't that funny? I said, Corey, you need to stop. I'm a behavior person and you're wrecking a book for me. Oh, you know what I'm talking about. Wait 10 seconds. No nagging. It's going to be the hardest thing you do in your entire life. I'll take you through the whole process right now, right? I'm going to model it for you. It's time to put your shoes on. That's 10 seconds. How many of you are waiting? We don't wait. It's like, look at me. Look at me. What did I tell you? They don't look at you. We take their face and click, look at me. Look at me. I don't know. I can make any behavior fun. It's just not fun when you go home. Now, if a child does not initiate a response, understand this. In the field of education and behavior, there is a concept called chunk size. Chunk size says, how much information can a person of particular ages process, respond to? So because you are parents of young children, up until second grade, they can only respond to, at most, 3 step directions, 3 chunk sizes. That's by second grade, 8 years old. But some of you have like 2.5-year-olds. They're 1 chunk size people, one chunk. Here's what that means. Please go upstairs. That's it. When you really want to say, please go upstairs, get your shoes, get your coat, bring it downstairs, and I'll meet you at the bottom. And sometimes we say that to kids, and they go upstairs because they heard the one chunk, and then we're yelling, hey, where are you? We're going to be late. And they're thinking, I did what you told me. You said, run upstairs. I did it. Why are you yelling at me? Sometimes we overwhelm children with too much information. And if you find that your child is not responding to your directions, I would have you step back and look at how many chunks you're giving them. I mean, for those of you that are professionals, you're not excused from this. Because I've been in a lot of preschool classrooms. And when we do transitions, we have transitions within transitions. All right, why don't you go over to your cubby and get your coat, bring it to the rug. When everybody has their coat on, we'll call your name so you can go back to the line you were at 10 minutes ago. And wait. But that's 4 chunk sizes. By the time the children are high school age, 5 chunk sizes. In early adulthood, 7 chunk sizes. And then my age, 1 chunk size. Now that I've gone to the garage. Why would I do such a crazy thing? So here's the deal. If it is true that we do or say things that we wish we hadn't after the fact, or if we give in, That then gives us some insight that says there might be different styles of parenting. And there are different styles of parenting. And so we go through this. Those are norms. We'll do that some other day. Different styles of parenting. So here's some styles of parenting for you. You may be authoritarian. You may be permissive. Or you might be what we call authoritative. But I found out in my own life, both as a child, living in a house with two different parenting styles and trying to figure all that out, and then having children and living with another adult who has a different style than I do, how really rare it is that we are unified in our approach. It's incredibly rare. So the reason it's rare that we're different, that we're the same in our approach is this, that in adult relationships, you have a tendency to attract the person least capable of meeting your needs. Which is another way of saying opposites attract. How many of you have noticed that? So if you're opposite of each other, it would make sense that you would have opposite styles. That makes perfect sense. So you say, well, what's authoritarian? Authoritarian is on this side. It's a style that is very high in structure, but very low in support. So that was my father. My father would say things like this. You want to live in my house, you follow my rules. You don't like it, get out. You want to cry, I'll give you something to cry about. My father also said, if we said as kids, I don't want to do that, I'm scared, he would say, remember your last name. I'm 58 years old. I don't know what that means. How's that going to help me? And then somewhere along the line, I changed my last name. So which one do I remember now? I don't know. Kind of weird. But my father was the leader. He ruled with an iron fist. When he was there and he said, do it, you did it. And you thanked him after you did it. He literally would say to us, you kids will have a great life if you do what I tell you to do, when I tell you to do it, and how I tell you to do it. That's authoritarian. Okay? Lots of structure. Lots of rules. But he's married to my mother. She's on the other side of the continuum called permissive. My dad was a school teacher, taught school for 35 years, which meant that he left in the morning before we left in the morning. He came home, changed his clothes, and then went to work in a factory at night because he was the sole support of the family and you couldn't live on a teacher's salary. So we were in bed before my dad came home. So he had a lot of rules, but he was never there, which left my mother to follow through on them. She couldn't follow through if she had to. I think she wanted to. She just couldn't do it. So she would say things like, if you don't eat your dinner, there'll be nothing to eat till the next meal. My brother and I would go, all right, whatever. Because we knew within a half an hour, as soon as you start to go, oh, I'm so starving. Cheerios. I just need a couple Cheerios. You're lovely, Mom. I'm like, good girl. I'll be a good girl tomorrow. Just a couple Cheerios. My mother would look at you and go, are you sure? I'll make you a hamburger. No, I want Cheerios with ice cream on the side. Was wait till your father gets home. Well, then I thought, all right, we'll be in bed. Yes. But now I realize she was tattling on us. To my father, those kids. But when I tattled on my brother, that's bad. Don't tattle. You do that to me every day. You tattle to him. So here's an authoritarian kind of statement. Get your butt over here before I smack you. Just go to a laundromat. You'll see it. And then you have the permissive statement. If you're permissive by default, it means that you don't say anything. You just let the kids do whatever. And if you're permissive by choice, they're just kids. That's what kids do. We would suggest that you find some balance. Now, I also believe that you don't have to parent the same way. Exactly the same way, because you are different people. But you do have to present as unified to your children. They have to see you as a team, and I don't care if you live in the same house with the other person who's the parent of the child or not. It is in your children's best interest for them to see those parents as a unified team in parenting. Easier said than done. So what's authoritative? It's the balance. It's the one that's also high in structure, but it is also high in support. Authoritarian, high in structure, low in support. Permissive, very high, low in structure and very high in support. Okay? You have to find the balance. Now listen, this is probably the most important thing that I will say here tonight. If you want to create a unified approach to parenting, take some time to develop a parenting vision. I don't know a lot of people. I have traveled this country numerous times. I have traveled to other countries numerous times. I do not know of an individual that will get up and talk about parenting vision. But it's so critically important. Because what we fight about is the lack of a unified vision. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Like, we don't even know what we're parenting toward. We'll just fight when we don't like what you did. So my husband and I were no different in that. I lean to the authoritarian side. He leads to the permissive side. Your temperament governs some of that. So we're trying to figure out how we're going to parent these three children. But we didn't always agree. And when we didn't agree, we were pretty vocal about it. Sounded like this. Why don't you just say no and mean no? Those kids have you wrapped right around their little finger. You're not helping them to learn responsibility. How many of you know those messages in your brother's house? And the messages that came back at me were, they're just little kids. Cut them some slack once in a while. And we went back and forth like it was ping pong. And the kids sometimes were there watching us like, who's winning? And I said to my husband, we can't do this anymore. We have to figure this out. So I think we should have a parenting vision. He said, what's that? I said, here's a piece of paper and a pencil. I want you to think about when you videotape ahead in your mind's eye and you see these kids at the age of 21 years old, when they're adults, going off to their own life, what do you hope you see in those children that was the result of our parenting? What qualities do you want them to have when they're 21 years old? I want you to write down 10 qualities, and I'll write down 10 qualities. And if you can't come up with 10, it's all right. Stop wherever you're at. And then we compare our lists. My number one, respectful. I want a respectful children. His number one, respectful. Yes. So far, so good. My number two, responsible. His number two, responsible. Wow, this is cool. Then why are we fighting? We fought from number three all the way to 10. My number three, resourceful. I want my children to know that you have internal strengths, that you can bounce back from challenges and adversity if you use those strengths. And don't become a victim of your circumstances. Rise above. And if you don't have a strength in a particular situation, it's okay. Somebody else would. And don't be afraid to ask for help. My husband's number 3, popular. Popular. Who is it? Is it popular? Who gives a rip? Janine, they have to be popular. Why? Janine, they have to be popular. You know what that led to? Our kids got involved in everything because you had to be popular. But who's going to give them a ride everywhere? It's like, I'm tired. Popular. I will tell you numbers 4 through 10 were worse than that. So we agreed that we would raise respectful and responsible children. And then it bothered me. Why popular? There's no connection to a child's future wellness and optimal functioning with popular. And then it came to me. We come from very different backgrounds. And I suppose if I met him at a much younger age, I probably would not even have talked to him. So I'll just give you a little bit of the background, not because I'm judging anybody's background, but because this is what created the problem. And I would submit to you that sometimes what's creating the problem is that you're coming from different places, but you don't talk about it. So I am from an upper middle class family. I grew up in Worcester. My father was a teacher. He had a PhD in education, which said to us as kids, you will get advanced degrees when you grow up. Formalized education was highly valued in my house. Highly valued. It was an expectation. And because my dad was a teacher, we used to travel. And that's how I got into traveling. Summer's off, you go wherever. Been all over the place. My parents, I am the youngest of 2 children. I have an older brother that's 2.5 years older than me. My parents were in a marriage for 65 years and would still be in that marriage if my dad did not pass away 4 years ago. Everybody came to our house. It was the place to be. People loved being at our house. So that's who I grew up. My mom didn't work. She stayed home and took care of the kids. She had advanced degrees too, but she never used them. She just stayed home and took care of the kids. Those are their choices. My husband is from a family of 4 boys. He is the youngest of the 4, and they are all 1 year apart. Born into a family of poverty, with a father who was an alcoholic, and a mother who was totally dependent upon and the enabler of the alcoholism. To this day, she's 86 years old. She has never driven a day in her life. She has difficulty making decisions. I don't ever have known her to make any major decisions. It's like, just tell me what to do and I will do it. Formalized education was not important to my husband or his family. Survival was. And in order for them to survive, those boys found out that in their community, you could belong to the boys' club for 25 cents a year. And that included all the ice time you needed to play hockey and the equipment. 25 cents a year. And all 4 of those boys spent all of their time at the boys' club for 25 cents a year. You say, why is popular so important? Because when you're popular, you can get a ride to your practice and your hockey game. When your father has the car at the bar and you don't have any way to get there, but that's how you survive. Or maybe you know what I'm talking about. When you're popular and your dad comes home and he's smashed and he's arguing with your mother, if you're popular, you have some place to sleep. in the poverty if you don't have the resources to eat and you're hungry. If you're popular, you can find somebody that will have you over for dinner. How many of you know why popular is so important for him? See, I'm not judging that. That's his life. But it doesn't mean that it has to govern our life, because we're not living in those circumstances. You following? So we don't have to be popular, Todd. They don't have to be involved in everything. We have a different life. But how many of you can see that his vision of a mom is different than my vision of a mom? And his vision of a dad is different than my vision of a dad. And how many of you know you bring all that stuff into parenting with you? And then you get a child with a developmental behavior, or even beyond that, challenging behavior, and that creates chaos in a family unit, because we're not unified to begin with. We have different ways to handle that. So when I say to you, parenting vision is probably the most important thing I will say to you tonight, I mean that. I hope that you will take it seriously. Go home and figure out, what are you parenting towards? And then align everything toward that. And even if you disagree with the other person, please do not do it in front of the children. There are outcomes to all of these styles. You have a right to choose the style you would like to use, but those are your outcomes. I'm not going to read them to you. If you decide to stay in an authoritarian style, that is a style that fosters aggression, little remorse, increased manipulation, and low resourcefulness in children. And if you are permissive by choice or default, you can expect to see in your children very little impulse control or delayed gratification, very low motivation, lots of not listening because there's no respect for authority, high escape or avoidance behaviors, and lack of self-control. You say, what about high escape behaviors? It's scary in today's world. Your state taught me this. A few years back, I was asked to come and do a training for all of the master's level licensed drug and alcohol counselors or something. And I made a statement in that training, because it was called Brains at Risk, and I made a statement that said, the average age of first experimentation with alcohol in the United States is 10 years old. And they laughed at me. And I said, why are you laughing? They said, that statistic changed last year. I said, what's the age now? 8 years old. Eight. And most of them are getting it from their home. That's a scary statistic. If you have a child that's into escape or avoidance, how many of you know that's a pretty quick escape? Tough stuff. So I don't think any of your parenting visions have that side as part of them. How many of you are on the right side? You're thinking, yep, that's the vision I want for my kid. There's nobody here. I think parents do the best they know how to do with the information they have. I also think that you have two goals in common, the same goals that I have. I want what is in the best interest of my children. How many of you want what's best interest of your children? How many of you also want a quality of life for your children that is equal to or better than the one that you have? I don't know parents that don't have those goals. But I also work every day, and I don't see that. You with me? So make your decision, but make an informed decision. What style would you like to be? And I believe that you want to be in your picture for your kids is the authoritative style. How many of you think that's true? You want your kids to be able to make wise choices? You want your children to have a healthy self-image? It's about parenting style. It's about the climate that we create for the kids. Get past that. This is the authoritative approach. If you're trying to figure out what creates the authoritative approach. So I move beyond boss and begging and bribing, this coercive kind of manipulative approach to my kids. What would I have to do? There are only five things. The first thing you need to do is to be able to anticipate and prevent. Prevention is the best intervention. You say, what does that mean? Prevention is about the relationship that you have with your child and the quality of the environment that you create for them. So I would say to you, the relationship is a relationship where you are working to meet the needs of the child. Okay? Needs are critically important. Some of you think there's kids that have some needs. Like needs for safety, needs for belonging, needs for love, needs for a lot of things, yes? Our environment needs to be created so those needs are met. I'm going to give you a lens of need. The lens of need is called first hour needs, and you have it on another slide in your packet. First hour needs. In my opinion, this is a strategy that I use probably more than any other strategy that I know. First hour needs. Here's what it says. Within the first hour of the day, your children have needs that they hope get met. And children are very poor at delaying the gratification of needs. And there are 10 first hour needs. Now, your children may not have all 10 of these needs. But not only do they have these needs, so do you. The challenge becomes when your need in the first hour is not the same as your child's need in the first hour. That's what we call a power struggle. A power struggle, by definition, is a clash of needs. So whenever you're in a power struggle with another person, it's because your needs are clashing. So here's your 10 first hour needs. There are some children in the first hour, and some of them, as soon as they wake up and before you wake up, have a need for acknowledgement. They're running into your room, they're slamming themselves on your bed, that's how you wake up. They're like, hi, hi, yeah, love you. It's morning. They just want somebody to say hi. Oh my goodness, I missed you. That was a long night, huh? See what they got? Oh, no. Acknowledgement. Listen, when children go to childcare, the teacher should meet the first hour need of the child in that environment. We want teachers to greet children. Hi, how are you? We're glad to hear the class wouldn't be the same without you. That's acknowledgement, not like, oh my God, here comes Andrew. Then he comes every day, even when he's sick. Acknowledgement. There's kids that come into childcare. They come in like this. I'm here. I got a new shirt. Watch my shoes, they light up. There are some children that have a first hour need for communication. Those are the kids. I just got to tell you one thing. Just one thing. That's my daughter. Well, can I tell you one thing? No, get in the shower. But Mom, I just got to tell you one thing. Good. Get in the shower and talk loud. No, Mom, really, just one thing. Then she'd go to school and get notes. Lovely child, pleasure to have in class, never stops talking. Called an unmet need. Listen, some of you at work have staff meetings. These individuals generally show up late. And then they talk to everybody. How was your weekend? So great to see you. I'm looking at the agenda going, you're not on it. Sit down. There are some children that have a first hour need for socialization. That means to play. And if there's something that's changed in our society, it's play. And we don't truly understand play anymore. Because play has become supervised. Play has become an indoor activity. Play has become a thing you do with store-bought things and machines. It's not an outdoor activity anymore that's unsupervised with natural materials. And Fisher-Price thinks it's okay to have eye potty chairs so they can play while they're shitting. $39.95, Amazon, eye potty chairs. Made by Fisher-Price. So I'm thinking, that's not called toilet training. How many of you know they gotta go sometime? You leave them there for 6 hours doing this, eventually they're gonna go. But here's the problem with that. The brain is an experience-dependent organ. Whatever the experience is, it wires the brain, and then the brain expects that same situation. And then when you repeat it, it strengthens the wiring. So now we're gonna have a whole bunch of kids that can only shit when they have an iPad. Which makes the workplace a really tough place to be. I had Dad the other night came up to me and said, we bought our son his own iPhone and iPad. I said, how old is your son? 2.5. What's he doing with it? He said, well, we bought it for him because my wife and I have very high-powered positions, and when we pick him up, we're tired. So we have all we can do to take him home, give him a bath, and then get him to bed. And then my wife and I, we play on our iPads. That's the way we sort of chill out for the night. Except he gets up and he interrupts us. I said, well, that's an interesting word. Interrupts. He said, yeah, I didn't think it was interesting till I came and listened to you tonight. He said, I think we're on the wrong track. I looked at him and said, I've never said this to a parent before, but you brought it up. You're on the wrong track. First hour need. Some children have a first hour need for socialization. That little guy just wants to be held, wants to be played with, wants to be talked to, wants to be with the parents who are busy on their iPad. Therefore, he's interrupting. There are some children that have a first hour need for physical activity. Any of you know those kids, as soon as they're up, they haven't stopped moving, right? There are other children that have a first hour need for relaxation. That's the opposite. They don't know they're up yet. They arrive at a program like, still in their pajamas, chilling. That's my son, Corey. I got first hour need, second hour need, ninth hour need, 23-hour need for relaxation. Amazing to me that kid's married. I tried to talk her out of it. We'll have no part of that. Some kids have a first hour need for touch. They're in your bed, snuggling. There are other children that have a first hour need for humor. How many of you know humor of a toddler? It's called bodily functions. And humor of a preschooler is a knock-knock joke with no punchline. But here's the worst part of that. You guys keep saying, who's there? They keep going, knock-knock, you go, who's there? Knock-knock, who's there? Knock-knock, who's there? It's over for them. That's all they know. If you hear them say, knock-knock, laugh, then it's done. You don't have to keep saying, who's there? It's done. Just laugh. But I found out in my career that there are a lot of people that suffer from humoroids. There is no humor in their life. No fun, no lightness, no playfulness. Get up, go to work, come home, same thing tomorrow. Get up, go to work, come home, same thing tomorrow. Don't answer this question. When was the last time you truly played with the innocence and the wonder and the curiosity and exuberance of a child your child's age? Because even if you did it, you're still worried about all the other adult stuff. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Like, you can't get there anymore. The best compliment I ever got in my my entire career was a parent that said to me one day, you know what I love so much about you? You never forgot what it's like to be a kid. It's fun being around you. Well, there's only one other choice. It's called being a crab in a bucket. So you know crabs in a bucket. Oh, that's so many. Oh, my God, my kids. Oh, my freaking kids. They whine all day long. See, some of you might work next to one of them. This is how you know. If you decide at the end of the day you need toilet paper, and you go down the store to the store to get toilet paper, and as you head down the toilet paper aisle, that person is in the toilet paper aisle, you're like, we don't need toilet paper today. What do you please? Something. Some children have a first hour need for structure. Those are the kids that are like, what are we doing today? What are we doing after that? What are we doing after that? Who's picking me up today? What are we up for lunch today? You cut it in squares, you cut it in triangles. I hate triangles. I'm having peanut butter. I hate peanut butter. You've been eating it for a whole month. I know, I hate it today. Just give me the structure. There's kids that just need a routine. And some of us fly by the seat of our pants. And then the last first hour need encouragement. That your kids need to know you believe in. You're their supporter. I say to kids all the time, don't compare yourself to those other kids. They already had their best day. Yours is still coming. Today could be it. I tell preschoolers things like this. You know what? The strategy you're using isn't working too well. But there's other strategies. I said, do you know what that is? They go, no, what's a strategy? I said to a kid the other day, I said, it's what you're doing and how you're doing it. You're using the wrong strategy. He looked at me and he said, today! Why didn't they tell me it was the strategy? How many of you know that's encouraging to a kid? Because it's not me. It's the strategy. That's a whole different message to a kid. Some kids need encouragement. Next thing we do is we set limits. Here's how we tell you about setting limits. Called the three-legged stool, and if any of you want to read any more details about any of this stuff, it's in that book over there. This is the heart. It is the emotions of your child. Your children's emotional development will follow a very stable pathway, and therefore their behaviors will stay consistent. If you will do three things, now it's broken, so I have to hold it. You'll know why in a minute. It's broken. Here's the three things that will provide the foundation to that emotional security for your children. The first leg of the stool is called rules. You need to have some of those. Rules. And I have found that parents make two mistakes in rule setting. One is, I don't set any. I know when you haven't. Because when I say to you, what do you want your child to do? You say things like, be good. Well, what does that mean? You know, just behave. That means you don't have any rules. You don't know what you want. And then I've been in houses where there's way too many rules. So my friend Brian, who at 4 years old, was on an IQ scale of 148, which is genius, but he's still 4 years old. And his mother came in one day and she said to me, he doesn't listen to anything I tell him. Absolutely nothing. Zero. Nothing. Why doesn't he listen to me? I said, I don't know. But if you do me a favor, write down all the rules you have for Brian. And when you have them all written down, bring them in. I'd like to take a look at them. A week later, she came in. Six notebook pages, both sides full of rules. Six notebook pages. And I went to Brian's dad and said, you know, would you do me a favor? Could you write down the rules that you have for Brian? When you have them written down, bring them in. I'd like to take a look at them. 3 days later, 12 rules written on a piece of toilet paper. Then I went to Brian. I said, hey, Brian. Jesse. He said, "Oh, Janine, that's cinchy." I said, "What are the rules, Bri?" He said, "There's only two." I said, "What are they?" "You can't eat with your feet on the table, and you have to wear your seatbelt." I went to Mom, 6 notebook pages, both sides, neither rule. On her seatbelt. How many of you not know why he doesn't listen to anything I tell him? Nothing, absolutely nothing. Nothing. I looked at Dad's list, one rule. Which one? "You can't eat with your feet on the table." I looked at Brian and said, "Brian, where'd you learn about the seatbelts?" He said, "Here in school." Now I have to tell the mom why he doesn't follow her rules. 6 notebook pages. That's over 122 rules for a 4-year-old. How many of you know it's hard enough to get him to follow 3? So the general rule of thumb around rules: a few rules followed is better than many not. And make sure that your rules are teaching the child what to do. Therefore, they should be stated positively. We walk in the house. Not we don't run in the house. We walk in the house. We run outdoors. Okay? Your rules are a tool of teaching. What do you want this child to do? If they're not eating, the rule is we eat at the table. Not stop fooling around and start eating because you're running out of time. We eat at the table. That teaches the child. Okay? Second leg of your stool. Once you have whatever those rules are, then you need some consequences to those rules. Consequences are an interesting thing because I have found out that for many parents and many professionals, it's the hardest thing that they ever have to do. We can't seem to get figure out, like, what is a reasonable consequence. I will tell you, because you are parents of young children, the most effective consequences for your children at the ages they are at right now are teaching consequences, not limiting consequences. Teach them. Here's what that means. If one of your children hurts another child, that child should be responsible for making it better. You need to stop playing, go get the boo-boo bunny, and bring it to your brother and hold it on his arm. Because it teaches empathy, and empathy is what will prevent them from causing harm to another person. The teaching consequence. So you may need some help sitting with some professionals to figure out consequences, because there's all types of consequences out there. I just learned that teaching consequences are the best. But for some reason, our lens is you have to punish the child to make them feel bad for them to be able to behave. Not true. You just have to teach them how to behave. The purpose of consequences are to teach responsibility. That's the purpose. So if you find that what you're doing is not leading that child to a higher level of personal responsibility, you may not be using consequences at all. Okay? I will also tell you this. Positive consequences are far more valuable than negative. And I will show you that right now. It's called the soggy potato chip theory. So if you have water and you have some potato chips, and you take those potato chips and you say, "Here's a nice crisp potato chip, and here's one that's a little soggy." And you're a young child. If I offered you a crisp potato chip and a soggy one, which one would you take if you were a young child? Okay. And again, you're still a young child, but now all I have is a soggy potato chip or no potato chip at all. What would a young child take? The soggy potato chip. That's the soggy potato chip theory. The crisp potato chip. I went to school for years to learn this stuff. Why do I use stuff like this? Because I go into houses all the time. You can't bring everything you might need. How many of you know, like,
You love somebody coming in with like four truckloads of stuff.
But if I said to you, you have a couple of potato chips,
people have said to me, you just want two potato chips? Yeah, because you can't eat just one.
And then I can show you the soggy potato chip theory. So here's what it is.
Crisp potato chip,
positive attention. Soggy potato chip,
negative attention. When you're given the choice between a positive consequence, positive attention, or a negative consequence, negative attention, what did you pick?
Positive. But when given a choice between negative
or no attention at all, what did you pick?
Negative.
Do you know that most houses operate off of the negative potato chip? When the kids are doing what they're supposed to be doing, we're not noticing.
But as soon as they misbehave, the soggy potato chip. Here's what I've just done to you. Might have been a little unfair.
How many of you will have an association to potato chips that you have never had before? And every time you see it,
or watch a commercial, go to the store, sit next to somebody at lunch, you're going to be thinking, what potato chip was I today? Soggy,
crisp, or no potato chip at all?
Am I noticing when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing? And I'm not talking about praising, I'm talking about noticing. Noticing says this, I notice that you sat next to your brother today and you built blocks. There is no praise to it whatsoever. It is up for your children to learn whether or not they evaluate whether it's good or bad. Not up for you to be the external police, okay? So you need some consequences. Positive, we will tell you, at a minimum, 9 times more positive than negative. So that might be some work for some folks. The last leg underneath the stool, we have rules, we have consequences to those rules, and then we have to do follow through on those rules. If you say this will happen, it needs to happen. You have to consistently follow through. And should you decide that any one of those is not necessary, and this is why this stool is so broken, because I've done this for 38 years, you rip out any one of those legs, and that's what happens to your child's heart. You put them on an emotional roller coaster of instability until they find somebody that creates that structure and stability for them. I don't think that's part of your parenting vision.
How many of you want your child to be that way in life? So emotionally volatile that...
It's not our goal.
You need 3 things, 3 legs to your stool. The next one is called acknowledge and validate emotions. That's a hard one for some folks.
So I'll just tell you a story about that. Another Brian. He lives in Rhode Island.
This little guy, he's the only kid in a preschool classroom. I am in that program to sign a contract as their mental health consultant.
I hear over the intercom at 11:30, Janine Fitzgerald, if you are still in this building, please report to room 7 immediately.
When I got there, there's a teacher that's having a really bad day. You can tell she's all sweaty, her hair's all messed up. I walk up the hall, she looks at me and she goes, oh, thank God you're here. Because I'm done with him. I have had it.
I thought, that's a crazy statement to make.
Give up all your authority in front of the child? So I said to her, listen, I know you're having a hard day,
but he doesn't need to know that.
So come on over here and I want to talk to you for a bit. But before I talk to you, I need to go talk to him.
I don't even know his name. But the teacher has already given up all the authority to me.
He doesn't know me. Never seen me before. So I walked over to him and I said, hi, what's your name?
He said, Brian. I said, hey, Brian, how you doing?
My name is Janine. And I want to tell you something, Brian. I'm really happy to meet you. Why would I do that to that child?
Why would I go to the child?
Acknowledgement.
Yeah. How do you think he's feeling when the person you know gives up all authority to a perfect stranger? I'm done with him. You take him. I have had it. What do you think the child is feeling?
Rejection, fear.
Acknowledgement of emotion says, even though he has not told me that, I need to validate his emotion. So I said to him, I said, Bri, I said, you're probably wondering what we're talking about over there, huh? He said, yeah. I said, Bri, here's what we're talking about. I'm talking to your teacher to figure out how we're going to make this better for all of us. That sound like an okay thing to you? He said, yeah. I said, what are we doing over there, Bri? He said, you're talking. I said, what are we talking about, Brian? I said, all we're talking about, Brian, is how we're going to make this better for all of us. So I'll be back. Then I went to the teacher and I said, listen, here's what I want you to do. I don't know what happened, but you can probably tell me what happened. Why is he sitting here crying? She said, because he threw sand in my eyes. So just at 11:30 in the morning, he picked up sand and whipped it in your eyeballs. Is that what you're telling me? She said, no. When did this start? 7:30 this morning. What happened at 7:30? She said he came in. She said, yeah, that's what they do. I said, what happened when he came in? He walked in and he said, I'm mad. I said, what did you do? She said, I told him to hang up his backpack and wash his hands because we were going to have some breakfast. I said, how did breakfast go? She said, not good. I said, what happened? She said, he put kicks in his bowl and threw him across the room. And what did you do? I told him since he had to pick him up, he should count him. How high can he count? This is a political agenda. How high can he count? She said, I don't know, he didn't count him. What did he do? He picked him up, put milk on him, and threw him across the room again. I said, listen, I get it. Here's what I'm going to say to you. You violated a principle. And the principle is this. If you don't listen to their whispers, you will force them to shout.
Sometimes your kids are whining, and that's the whisper. And there are people out there that will tell you ignore.
I'm going to tell you something. There are some kids that if you ignore it, get ready for the shout. You can't ignore the whisper. You might be able to ignore behavior, but you can never ignore the need that's behind the behavior. That child was trying to tell his teacher he was mad, and she was not responding to it. Therefore, at 11:30, I whip sand in your eyes and ignore that. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to walk over to him. I want you to walk in a way that, you know, not like you're tired, not like you're mad, not like you're drunk, not like you're anything. Just walk. And when you get where he is, I want you to sit on the same side of the table that he is sitting at, and I want you to lean back. And then I want you to say to him, Brian, I know you're mad because you told me you were when you came here this morning and I didn't listen to you. And then you threw your cereal, and I still didn't listen to you. And then you threw sand in my eyes, and that tells me that you're mad. So what are we going to do to work together, Bri, to make this better for all of us? Now I'll show you what she did. Show how effective a coach I am. We're standing over here. She could have described it to me. Explained the whole thing as I described it. Here's what she did. Brian! I know you're mad. Why are you mad? That's what I told her to do, right? Brian stood up, put his hands right next to hers. Their nose was more like this. He leans in and he says, because I'm sitting here with my coat on and I'm sweating. I wanted to say, hit her. Hit her, Brian, hit her. consequence.
Like, why can't we just acknowledge the emotion?
You're mad. What can we do to make it better? How many of you know people like it when you acknowledge their emotions? Because then they don't have to escalate their behavior to prove to you how they feel. Don't ignore the whispers. They're there for a reason. Acknowledge and validate emotions. When your kids say for the first time, I hate you. I hate you. I'm going to live with Grandma. Don't say to them, but I love you. Make them feel like a schmuck. No, I'm your mother. You love me. Talk to me. Like, no, I'm pretty sure I hate you right now. I'm pretty sure. See, that was my brother and I used to say all the time, I hate him. My mother would say, oh, you don't hate him, you love him, he's your brother. Hug him. Why do you want somebody who hates him? Hug him. It's awful. Just acknowledge and validate emotions. You might feel that way right now. That can change. And when the child calms down, that's the time you do the teaching, not at the point of high emotion. Okay? Just acknowledge and validate the emotion. The next thing we do is teach new skills. There are a lot of skills to teach. I will tell you, in today's world as parents, we are counting on you to be our partners in the teaching of two skills, two sets of skills. Parents of young children should be teaching the skills of self-regulation to children. There are a lot of kids that can't regulate their activity level. There are a lot of children that can't regulate their emotions. There are some children that can't regulate their sleep, their eating, their toileting, any of that stuff. That's all regulatory functions. And the mastery of the physiological functions, sleep, eating, and toileting, is done by the toddler years. Emotions begins to be taught in the toddler years and continues to the 16th birthday. So first we have to teach kids to say, I feel mad. So when your toddlers are developing language, teach them four emotion words. Mad, happy, sad, and scared. That's it. Four. So that they can use those words as they get older, and they won't have to have tantrums anymore to tell you that they are mad, because now I have a word to tell you. And when you teach it, please teach them to say, I feel, and not I am. Sounds like a very small thing, but it's not a small thing. I feel means it's transitory. It comes and it goes, because that's what emotions do. They ebb and flow like the ocean. But when you keep saying, I am mad, your brain will make that a self-fulfilling prophecy. I feel. And only one of four words. Happy, sad, scared, or mad. So that's a whole teaching in itself. I'm not going to go into any more of that. The second set of skills that are critically important in today's world is called social language. That there are a lot of children that don't know how to greet other people. They don't know how to initiate play. They don't know how to extend their play. Because they play with machines and they don't play with people. I know a lot of kids that don't know that they should say hi. I know a lot of kids that don't know they should look at somebody's face when they're in a conversation. And it does not necessarily mean that they're on the autism spectrum. It's just a reflection of our society. We're not doing a good job of teaching it. How many of you know there are some children that don't have what's called requesting skills? They demand. That's how you know. If you have a five-year-old and they want their shoe tied, this is what they do. See, a requesting skill would say, could you do me a favor? Could you help me to tie my shoe, please? Kids don't know how to do that. There are children that are like, you do it. You get it. And there are adults that are responding to it. So all of those skills have to be taught to kids. And the last thing we do with our children is communicate. And here's a quick activity, and you don't have to do it tonight, but I want you to spend some time on this activity called the Bug and Brad List. I want you to think about one of your children. And in a Franklin T, on one side write Bug and on the other side write Brad. Make two columns. And then as you think about that child, write down everything about that child that bugs you. How many of you know this stuff about every kid that bugs us? It's like, oh. They have what's called button behaviors. Like if they never did it another day, we would be happy as could be. And then on the other list, I want you to write down everything you can brag about that child. List all of the strengths of the child. And I would encourage you every day to spend more time in your brag list than the bug list. But I have done this in family coaching with thousands of families. And every time we do the bug and brag list, they do the bug list first, even if you put the brag list first. The bug list is the one they do first. The bug list is longer, and the bug list is what the child hears over and over and over again. Stop doing that. That's annoying. Stop. Don't pick your nose. Get your hands out of your face. Stop. Don't put that in your ear. You know last week. And we've created this thing called the society. I want to write that book. I want to call it Habiting. I can't write it because I don't know how to spell it. But that's what society's become for children. They're fearful. Because everything they do is go. If they're right here and they walk to you, it's like, get over here. Somebody could have stolen me. I'd be so sad.
They go near a puddle, they're like,
you'll catch pneumonia. You'll be in the hospital. Let's get somebody with, like, an old 69,000 or whatever that thing is that's going around. I saw a program the other day that closed the slide. Toddlers, closed the slide because there was a puddle at the bottom. If you understand early childhood, there's 18 inches deep of wood chips. It's the right surface for that. Like that. I can fix this. I walked over, took some of those 18 inches, and went like this. Filled the hole. No puddle anymore. Took the stop sign away. Okay, kids, you can slide. Teacher was furious. They'll get wet. Listen. Communicate with children. Communicate possibilities. Communicate strengths. Communicate with them. Communication means dialogue. Two people talking. And the saddest statistic that I know, other than the one I told you earlier, which is 8 years old is the age of first experimentation with alcohol, is this statement. The studies about communication between parents and children in the United States today is that dads talk with their children 12 minutes a week. And moms talk with their children 20 minutes a week.
You say, I do a lot more talking.
Yeah, bossing, begging, and bribing. That's not communication.
You following? Mm-hmm. That's orders.
Communication is, are you sitting with your child? Undivided attention. No media. No technology. No disruptions. And the most important thing that is happening at that point is what is happening between us. And sometimes there's more communication in silence with your kids than in words.
Spend time with them.
Do not buy into the myth. It's quality time. It is not quality time. It has never been quality time. It is quantity time with quality interactions. That's what's healthy for children. Make sure it happens. Fair enough?
Okay, I can ask. You can ask questions. We gotta get microphones. Anybody have any questions? You want me to answer? I'll hang out afterwards too. If you want to answer, ask in private. Because again, you know, these people are gonna be at the grocery store and they're going.
Oh, okay. We can do that.
Yeah. The consequence is what you intend to do. The follow-through is you actually do it.
So I intend to, when this child does this, I intend to do this, but then when it happens, I don't do that. So then there's no follow-through. So there's three pieces to the rule, the consequence, and then the follow-through. That's what I said earlier. Mean what you say, say what you mean, and don't say it means. Okay? If you mean it, you'll follow through. If you don't, it just becomes an idle threat. Does that help? Okay? Yes?
At what age are kids able to start understanding this kind of communication? Like, I know it's never too early to start, you know.
Yeah, the question is at what age do children start to understand all the communication? And, you know, when we talk about early literacy, the key to early literacy and the development is the establishment of a sophisticated vocabulary. So I would ask parents not to water down the communication. Explain to the children. So there are parents that really talk down to their kids. There's adults that do that too. Here's a teacher that's first grade. When she wants to gain the attention of the kids in her class, she does things like, class city class. Oh, wow, study class. What 7-year-old do you know is going to respect somebody that's like, class? Like, they think she's a joke. So I would ask that you don't talk down, don't use the baby talk, but at the same time, you can't use so sophisticated that they can't grasp it. But, you know, I don't know that there's like a firm age. Kids, the development of kids is so variable that it could be 6 months either way of the milestones, and it's still within the norm. So I'll just give you an example. A little girl that I was with, 5 years old, she said something, and I said to her, that's very impressive. And she just kind of looked at me. And I said, do you know what that means? And she said, no. And I said, well, come on down to the beach and I'll show you. I said, when I get to the beach, I'm going to put my hand in the sand and I'm going to press down and then I'm going to take my hand out. And if you want to do the same thing, feel free to do so. And then we took our hands out and I said to her, so what do you see? And she said, hands. I said, no, you don't. You see an impression of a hand. So when I said, your words were impressive, it means that it's going to leave, it's going to stay with me for a while, like those prints are staying in the sand. See? She didn't understand the concept, but when it was done, she understood the concept. You following? So I wouldn't shy away from, like, I talk to kids that are toddlers about respect, but I also teach them what respect sounds like, what respect looks like, so that they know what the word is. Okay? And then temperament, because there's a lot of variables there. Temperament comes into play. My temperament is overwhelmed by too many words. But there are others that need an overabundance of words in my lens. Okay? So there's a lot of variables, but the one thing I know for sure, I would not water down. I would not condescend in my language. Okay? Yes?
Time out, yes or no?
Time out, yes or no? I don't know. What's your definition of time out?
Time by themselves.
Okay.
In the same place when there's a consequence to it.
Okay. Well, there's a difference between timeout, which is called timeout from positive reinforcement, which is you're 3 years old, therefore you sit for 1 minute of every year of age you are, and I'll tell you when you can get up, and you have to be quiet for that length of time. That's called timeout. There are things that are called taking a break, cooling off. And it sounds like you combine both of those things. I am in favor of take a break. I know that people of all ages need breaks. Okay? I am not in favor of taking all autonomy away from a child and telling them you cannot move until you're quiet for 3 minutes. Why? Because I had breath.
Brett is the strongest willed kid on the face of the earth, and it could take you 3 years to get him quiet for 3 minutes. And that was followed by having Erin, who when you put her in timeout, sat there yelling, "Hey, I'm still here! Is anybody listening to me? I got something I gotta tell you! Hey!"
And I thought, this isn't working.
So when I say take a break, it's part of teaching self-regulation to children, which really begins with emotions in the preschool, toddler and preschool years. But I don't think it's okay just to sit kids in a vacuum with their own emotions and help expect them to be able to control themselves and pull themselves back together. I think it's important for us to give them some sort of tools to use to be able to do that so they learn. So some kids, you know, do need different outlets. And I wish we had more time because we could talk about what some of those are, but I think take a break is what we do in life. I don't think we do time out in life. Okay? What we do is called prison. Yeah. 25 years of life time out. You sit in there as long as I tell you to, and I'll tell you when you can come out. All right? One more question? Yes, in the back.
So you were talking about brushing your teeth, and you said 3 to 5 feet, use the right body language, wait 10 seconds, then what?
You repeat the process. So if the child doesn't initiate a response, then you repeat the direction, you wait another 10 seconds. If the second time the child does not initiate a response, your responsibility is to move to action, okay? That means numerous things depending upon the child, and again, I wish I could tell you what it meant for you and your child. But it could mean, you know, for some children it means hand-over-hand assistance. For other children, I would never go there. And I might implement some sort of consequence that's logical or natural. The natural consequence of not brushing your teeth is you go to the dentist and you get pain. The logical consequence would be that if you know the child is having difficulty because it's happening at 7:30 just before bed or 6:30 just before bed, depending upon the age of the child, toothbrushing should happen earlier in the night before the child is incredibly fatigued. So it happens, but it happens as a logical consequence. Does that make sense? Like, we're not going to do it when you're tired. We're going to do it earlier.
Mine is more just he's busy. He's distracted. He's doing something he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking of brushing the teeth in the morning. We got to get going. It's time to go. Uh-huh. So I would do what you said, which is go take his hand, bring him in the bathroom. Here's your toothbrush. And mm-hmm. then he would do it. But you can only do that with so many things every day.
Yeah. And, you know, and I can't, there's not enough information for me to understand, like, all the variables that I could give you. I can tell you this. There's always more than one approach. So, you know, if hand over hand is working for you, I may not change that. But somebody else that may not work for, and you're looking for something else. I mean, an alternative is, where is the child going to? And could he do it when he gets there? I mean, that's another alternative. So there's a lot of, there's always choices. I just don't know specifically what they are for your question. Okay?
So helpful.
All set?
Thank you so much, Janine. We really appreciate it. I'd like to remind everyone that Janine does have copies of her book, The Dance of Interaction, available. She'd be happy to sign them if you'd like copies. And also, if you wouldn't mind filling out the program evaluations mailing list, if you want to be added to the mailing list, that would be great. Someone asked about certificates of attendance. I do have those available up front if you'd like to take a copy. Thank you.